Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Stephanie C. She's the media coordinator with the Montana-based Buffalo Field Campaign, the only group working in the field, in the courts, and in the policy arena in defense of this country's last wild migratory buffalo, the Yellowstone population. Stephanie's been on the front lines with Buffalo Field Campaign for 12 years, and from the direct interactions and experience with these gentle giants, she and her comrades have come to the understanding that while we may be trying very, very hard to save the buffalo are desperately trying to reach us, to teach us, to save us from ourselves. So first, I would like to thank you for your work, and second, I would like to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
Well, thanks. So the first question is, tell me about, and tell everybody about your activism.
Well, as far as Buffalo Field Campaign goes, I started out as a volunteer there, and I have been the media coordinator there for the past, I guess, 11 years now. And basically, we run daily field patrols. Usually, our field season runs from November through May and sometimes into June. And that's when the buffalo are migrating out of Yellowstone into the state of Montana, where they enter an extreme conflict zone. And what we do is we run daily field patrols, morning and afternoons, and sometimes even into the night, going to the locations where bison migrate into the Hebgen and Gardner basins, which are both west and north of Yellowstone, respectively. And we monitor their migration. We are on the landscape with them. And when agents with the Department of Livestock, the Park Service, the local Fish and Wildlife and Parks Agency, when they come out to harass or kill them, we are on the ground with cameras, and we document all the actions made against the buffalo, and we share that footage, and we share our firsthand experiences with decision makers, with First Nations, with our supporters, with the general public, with the media. And we just try to really raise a lot of awareness, show people exactly what's going on out there, and let people know what they can do to try to stop these atrocities from happening to the buffalo. But, you know, we get to spend a lot of time on the ground with them. We're on the landscape where they are. We're tracking them. We're standing by them. And it's not always a bad time. You know, there's good days when the agents aren't around, and we get to have incredible experiences with these gentle giants and with all the wildlife that live in this fascinating ecosystem.
So why, I mean, a lot of people probably don't know much. Give some history of buffalo, and I mean, presume people don't know anything about either buffalo or why they are being harassed and killed by the Park Service and OWL.
Okay.
So go ahead and give us just the history of this.
We can go back 500 years, I suppose, with the invasion of European culture and their attempted subjugation of the First Nations culture that lived here. And as you have articulated so well, they invoked genocide across this continent in order to dominate and control. And the buffalo being an integral part of First Nations buffalo cultures to attempt to subjugate those indigenous people, of course, would be to wipe out the buffalo. And they tried very, very hard to do that. And, you know, millions and millions, there were at least 60 million buffalo that once roamed from, you know, Canada to Mexico, from Virginia to Washington State. And now we have less than 4,500 wild migratory buffalo left. They were gunned down. They were murdered by the tens of millions in a very short period of time, in less than 20 years. And now the vast majority of buffalo that live on the landscape are contaminated with cattle genes. They live behind fences. They are managed as livestock. And the Yellowstone population is very unique in that as the 19th century slaughter was happening, there were 23 individual buffalo that sought refuge in what is now Yellowstone National Park in the Pelican Valley. And when they were discovered by the cavalry was sent in to protect them. And from this population we have today, the last continuously wild migratory bison left in the country. And one of the reasons that there's such a heavy-handed mismanagement of these incredible animals is mainly the livestock industry. The livestock industry is a murderous industry from the get-go, and they wanted to clear the land to make room for invasive cattle, and they have done a very good job of doing that. And it's not only buffalo that have suffered from the livestock industry, as pretty much everyone knows, wolves, prairie dogs, you name it. They've all been murdered for the cattle industry. And so in the state of Montana, you have the government of the state of Montana, like a lot of western states, was set up by the livestock industry. And the buffalo are a migratory species. They move with the seasons and the changing availability of forage, returning to calving grounds, returning to rutting grounds, and they move across the landscape. And Yellowstone National Park is located on a very high plateau, a caldera, actually, and the snows get extremely deep there. I mean, they can get to 12 feet deep at times in places, and the buffalo have to leave in order to get to food. I mean, they're pretty well adapted to live in the cold and pretty well adapted to live where there's snow, but that's too deep for pretty much any animal that doesn't hibernate. And so when bison migrate out of Yellowstone National Park, they cross the man-made boundary into the state of Montana, and Montana's response has been, up until recent years, to shoot them on sight. And in the winter of 1996-97, it was a very bad winter. There was a lot of deep snow fell, accumulated, and then it got warm, and a lot of that snow melted, and then it got really cold again, and so that snow became frozen like concrete, and the buffalo could not crater. They can use their huge head to sweep snow aside to get down to the grass, which elk and deer and other ungulates also benefit from. But that winter, it wasn't happening, and a lot of buffalo, over 1,000, died from winter mortality, and many hundreds more migrated into Montana, and 1,084 buffalo were gunned down by the state of Montana, by the Department of Livestock. And our campaign co-founder, Mike Meese, this is before BFC was in existence, had been there seeing this, and he was documenting it, and he sent some tapes out to a lot of First Nations leaders, and Rosalie Little Thunder, who was a Lakota elder, responded, and together they decided that there needed to be a presence on the ground, people needed to be bearing witness, we needed to be documenting, standing with the buffalo so that people could see what was going on out there. And that is how Buffalo Field Campaign formed, and we're still there, 18 years later. The buffalo are still migrating, even in the face of all of this abuse and killing, they will not be stopped, and that is a beautiful thing, but it's a terrible thing to see what they have to suffer for following their instincts, for being buffalo.
And where, if they were, you keep saying that they're migratory, if they were allowed to roam, where do you think that they would go? Would they, I mean, I don't know, would these particular buffalo want to migrate all the way down to Oklahoma, or would they just want to go into a valley in Montana? What do you think they would do?
I mean, the short version of that is they would go into, they would probably head through the west and go down into Idaho. They would head west and go into other portions of Montana. They would head north and go into the plains, Front Range regions of Montana. And eventually, I'm sure, I have no doubt that in the long term, they would reclaim all of their land, all of the suitable habitat that remains. They would reclaim that, and they need no help from us other than to get out of their way.
So before we go further, I have a couple more questions I want to ask. One of them is that, you know, we have talked, you and I have talked privately, and also I'm sure we've talked to other people about this too, about this culture's hatred of wolves and how there is this just visceral hatred of wolves. But it's occurring to me too that, and of course this culture hates nature in general, but bison have been slaughtered in numbers even larger than the wolves. And first, do you know much about, and do you want to talk about wood bison, or do you not want to go there too? Because wood bison were, in the United States, were completely wiped out prior to going after the plains bison. And then,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead. Go, please.
I don't know enough about, I don't honestly know that there is a very distinct wood bison, plains bison. I mean, these buffalo, once upon a time, were all contiguous across the landscape. And I think it was just, you know, geographically, you know, some were in more forested areas, but they still had contact with those in the plains. And the plains are definitely the heart of their habitat. And but I don't know a whole lot about the wood buffalo other than there's very similar mismanagement, maltreatment, abuse, killing that's gone on.
Well, what I was going to get to with the first question is, do you perceive a similar hatred of the buffalo as there is of wolves when you talk to cattle people? Like, we know that cattle ranchers generically sort of hate prairie dogs. You know, if you just talk to one for 10 minutes, they hate coyotes. They hate wolves. I've spent a lot of time in the West and I've lived in the West my whole life, and I don't think I've experienced a cattle rancher hatred of bluebirds. I think that's about as far as I can say. But do they just shoot them because, I mean, we know that they hate them underneath, but is there the rhetoric of hatred that there is for the wolves, prairie dogs, etc.?
There is. I guess it hasn't been as public, you know? I mean, they definitely hate them. I mean, their actions.
Oh, I know from their actions. I'm wondering in this case about rhetoric.
You hear it at meetings. When you go to meetings, you see bumper stickers with buffalo with the no with the slash through it. I mean, you hear all kinds of just misrepresentation of what these animals are about, that they'll, you know, eat your children, give your children diseases, that destroy your property. And, I mean, there's definitely a deep-rooted prejudice and hatred against the buffalo, and I think it just extends to everything that's wild, everything that they can't control, everything that they want to control. But yeah, I would definitely say that there is a deep-seated hatred, and it's very close to the hatred that is expressed towards indigenous cultures, period, non-human and human alike, and buffalo and First Nations people being so intertwined. I think the hatred is intricate for the people as it is for the buffalo. It's
right.
Very sad.
So there's another direction I want to go for a second too, which is you have talked extensively about the – not here today – about the role that buffalo play in the plains. And – can you talk about the buffalo are really important and wonderful and beautiful for themselves, but can you talk about their importance to the larger natural communities of whom they are a part? We know that prairie dogs, for example, form a prey base for all sorts of species, and they are incredibly important, or salmon are really important to the growth of trees. It ends up that salmon-bearing forests that have salmon in them, the trees will grow, I believe it's three times faster when there are salmon in the rivers than when they aren't. Three times faster.
I love love that.
And so can you talk about the relationships in a healthy community, not now, but what would have been the relationships between bison and, oh, which word should I use? Does it matter?
I mean, I use buffalo. We use both. Buffalo just feels more natural to me.
Okay. So anyway.
But whatever.
Okay, great. So can you talk about the relationship between buffalo and other species?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, buffalo are the landscape. They are the grasses that grow. And we're talking about healthy, intact, native prairies. The way their hooves are shaped, they till the soil. Their poop fertilizes the soil. They carry seeds on their coat, which helps spread the seeds around to other places. And they're food for grizzly bears. They're food for wolves. They're food for people. The prairie dogs benefit from the way that the buffalo graze, and the buffalo benefit from the way that the prairie dogs live on the landscape. The buffalo, oh my God, they are the landscape. They're the sovereignty of the land. And there are also some thoughts from Rosalie Little Thunder used to talk about this, about how the buffalo would help bring the rains with their migrations by waking up the aquifers under the ground. And I'm still contemplating that whole thing, but it's really a fascinating thing to think about.
No, go ahead.
They're just extremely, the way they move across the landscape, and I have seen this, it is amazing to see when they have moved through a place, how they graze. They just clip the grasses. They don't yank them out by the roots, you know. They just clip the grasses and they move on. They kind of create their own habitat, you know. And they can move in the hundreds through an area, and there's all these little tiny plants there that they have moved through, these ginormous animals, and everything's intact. Everything is wonderful. They're just, it's amazing how gentle, how respectfully they move through the landscape. I mean, they're so important. It's really hard to express how important they are. And it is also hard to know a lot about what we're missing, because there's so much we don't know, because the first response was to kill them.
I've read somewhere, and let me know if this is true, I've read somewhere that their wallows, and let me know if wallows is correct, and even what it means, are also really beneficial to migratory waterfowl. Have you heard
Absolutely.
About that?
Yes, and amphibians, all kinds of animals, millions and millions of wallows. Wallows are like when buffalo get on the ground and kind of scratch their backs, and you know, they're either trying to scratch an itch or remove shedding fur, or bulls will urinate in a place and then wallow to mark some territory, mark their scent. And when the rains come, these wallows fill up with water, and it provides habitat for songbirds and amphibians and all kinds of life. There's so many benefits to buffalo on the landscape.
So what is the excuse that is used? Okay, so we have these buffalo who are incredibly important, and they've been reduced down to 23, and they have a refuge in a place that they sought refuge in, but is not actually ideal habitat for them because it's really cold and deep in the winter. So they want to migrate out, and what's the problem?
The problem is the livestock industry.
Yeah, and what's the excuse used by the livestock industry to kill them?
The excuse, and that's what it is a cattle disease that came to this country with cattle called brucellosis. And it's such a non-issue. I mean, brucellosis is what it will do, and it mostly impacts females. Well, it impacts female buffalo. I really hesitate to call them cows, so you'll have to pardon me. It can cause them to, if they get it, it can cause them to miscarry. And they will miscarry once and then resume normal birthing cycles, and they develop antibodies, so they have developed a resistance to the disease. And the same holds true for cattle. So it's really not a big deal. Just let them get it, and it's over. let's move on.
And elk
But
get it too, right?
and elk get it too, and elk have been implicated in transmitting it in Montana, in Idaho, in Wyoming, and elk are free to roam. So, I mean, and also this disease, humans can get it, and they used to get it from drinking unpasteurized dairy milk, cow milk, but since the advent of pasteurization, that part hasn't been a problem. But if you're say you're hunting elk or bison or deer in the greater Yellowstone area, you've probably eaten brucellosis exposed meat. But if you are field dressing an elk, say that's infected with brucellosis, and you have a cut on your hand and you're handling reproductive tissues, you could get it. And then it's called Bang's disease in humans. It doesn't kill you. You live. It's you know, it's not even high on the list of the CDC, Center for Disease Control. It's just really a non-issue, but it's being used as a very, scare tactic excuse by the livestock industry because they want to control the movement of the buffalo. They want to prevent them from restoring themselves on the landscape because this is all about grass and who gets to eat it. This is a centuries-old range war that is continuing to this day.
And so what happens to this day is that when the buffalo leave the park to come down to a warmer, more hospitable place, then what does the Park Service, Department of Livestock, et cetera, do at this point?
Well, it's gotten really complex over the years. Initially, back in the 80s and 90s, Montana would shoot them, period. And sometimes they would call hunters out and actually literally point out buffalo for so-called hunters to shoot. And then the state of Montana ended up suing Yellowstone National Park for allowing the buffalo to migrate into Montana. And through a court order, they were forced to create an interagency plan, which became the Interagency Bison Management Plan, and that was signed under the Clinton administration in 2000. And in that plan, there are several different quote-unquote management tactics that these agencies use. It's a joint state, federal, and now tribal plan. The Montana Department of Livestock, Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, Yellowstone National Park, Gallatin National Forest, because those are the forest lands that surround Yellowstone, USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, they were the evil lords of it all, and now we also have the Nez Perce Tribe, the Confederated Salish Kootenai Tribe, and the Intertribal Buffalo Council, which is a federally chartered, basically a bison ranching cooperative, are all part of this current interagency bison management plan. And under the plan, when bison migrate into Montana, they today are initially shot by hunters pretty much right at the boundary of Yellowstone through a state hunt and various treaty hunting, which all told, because the tribes set their own seasons and quotas, all told lasts for 6 months and ends about a month before calving season. And I don't even want to, I mean, I can tell you about the fetuses that we find in gut piles. It'll break your heart. And then there's also a tactic that they use called hazing, which is not a nice word. That basically is to just out of fear or some other terrible way to force an animal to leave an area that they were occupying. And they haze. They used to haze with snowmobiles in the wintertime, but hunting has kind of made that subside a little bit. But so the cowboys, all dressed up in their cowboy finery, paid for with federal tax dollars, come out to chase buffalo off of the ground that they choose to be on.
Including newborn infants.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and including mothers that are in the throes of labor. I mean, there's documentation of hooves coming out of a mother buffalo's vagina as she's being hazed. I mean, it's just, it's abusive what these people are doing. and brand new. And we've seen baby buffalo hazed to death, just days old, minutes old. It's incredible. And or sometimes these guys, these cowpokes, they'll try to separate a mother that's in labor from the rest of the herd and haze the herd. These are herd animals. There's safety in numbers. They need to be together. She is completely vulnerable, and her baby is completely vulnerable. And it's not like they're going to stay behind anyway. They will follow the family. They will stay with the family. It's just a bunch of, it's lip service. But another darker aspect even to this management scheme is there are buffalo traps. One is located on the western edge of Yellowstone National Park in the Hebgen Basin. The other is located inside Yellowstone National Park on the north boundary in the Gardner Basin. Hundreds of buffalo have been captured and shipped to slaughter through these facilities. The one in the Gardner Basin has been used most over all these years. And it was used last year. Over 500 buffalo were shipped to slaughter, and it's sick. I have had I don't know if I want to call it an opportunity, but I've been to this trap. A bunch of us have been there in the past on what they call media tours, which they hide the blood, they wash the blood off the walls before you get there, and it's a fortified cattle operation. And You can smell the fear there. You can smell the fear. It is a wicked place. And the Park Service is running this. The National Park Service. They are rounding up wild bison, trapping them, running them through squeeze chutes, putting them through tests, poking and prodding, separating moms from babies, sisters from sisters. It's just destroying family structures and cramming them into livestock trucks, sometimes the big old semi-size livestock trucks, cramming them into those and shipping them off to slaughter. And in the past 2 years, it used to be that the state of Montana, the Department of Livestock, would ship the buffalo to slaughter, and the meat would be donated to, food banks and tribal charities. And now, in the past 2 years, the Intertribal Buffalo Council and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes have signed slaughter agreements with Yellowstone National Park, and they are now taking their relatives to slaughter in this manner. And there are many indigenous people that are very upset, as you can imagine, with this mistreatment. It's been a horrific bunch of years, and it seems that these agencies just continue to keep coming up with more and more nefarious ways of treating these animals. There's also a program, and I'm afraid it's about to rear its ugly head again, called Quarantine. They did a quarantine feasibility study a few years back where, as they were capturing buffalo to ship them to slaughter, they were testing they were testing calves for if they had been exposed to brucellosis. They only do blood tests if they are going to test. They only do blood tests, and blood tests do not determine actual infection. Blood tests only show if an animal has been exposed, which means that from what we have discovered, that over 95% of the buffalo that have been deemed infected because of a positive blood tests have actually had the resistance, the antibodies to brucellosis. So everything about this whole management scheme is wrong. And anyway, the quarantine feasibility study started by orphaning these calves. Their families were shipped to slaughter. These calves were taken just a few miles north of Yellowstone, put into a former game preserve behind double electric fence, a place run now by APHIS and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and they wanted to create a disease-free herd. And this is their response. This is their answer to restoring wild bison on the landscape, is to raise them as cattle, as domestic livestock, treat them as livestock, test and abuse them over and over and over again. For up to 5 years, they were treated this way, and there was breeding programs, whatever. And then this is how they say that First Nations can get buffalo back on the landscape, buffalo from this population back home on their tribal lands. It's a slap in the face. It's, I mean, a lot of Native Americans that we work with definitely liken it to the missionary schools, you know, and it, unfortunately, it sounds like there is the potential for operational quarantine coming down the road. The Department of Interior is attempting to make this happen, and that's going to be a very bad thing. And it, what's even worse is that, I mean, you can't put buffalo behind fences. And these buffalo, when they go to the tribal lands, or with, if they ever go to any other public lands, they still remain behind fences. They live in quarantine conditions. You cannot call this wildlife restoration. And yet there are groups, and I'm going to name one of them, Defenders of Wildlife, that ultimately supports this and says it's the only way that wild bison will ever be restored on the landscape. And meanwhile, migration happens every year, and the buffalo are doing it by themselves every year. And we've got these political fences that we need to take down as much as we need to take the physical ones down. I get very angry talking about this. I'm sorry.
No, there's no reason to apologize. You know, there were a bunch of directions like I was thinking to go when you were talking about this, but I think the direction to go might be, you know, I think that no matter whether someone is talking about trying to protect Florida panthers or Columbia River salmon or the buffalo or, you know, just – or bull trout, it doesn't matter. You know, one of the nice things about being, you know, writing on these issues is that I do get to talk to activists all over the country and all over the continent. And so many activists have told similar stories of their desperation and sorrow and rage. And I've never forgotten something that somebody said to me, gosh, this was probably 1997 or so in at this conference. I gave a small talk, and then this woman came up to me afterwards, and she was a anti-pesticides activist. And she said a line that I've never forgotten, which is, she said, "Sometimes I feel like the only things that keep me going are rage and sorrow." Mm-hmm. And that's not to say she's not full of love, of course. That's not it at all. But, I mean, can you talk about... I think it would be helpful to a lot of activists to just hear this spoken in public, to talk about the rage and sorrow and discouragement and what it is like to actually look at the bison and have the bison look back at you.
It happens all the time. And I mean, I guess to even just start off, though, is, like I said, there are those days, and sometimes there's many of those days, when nothing bad is happening, and we get to be with the buffalo, just with them on the ground, on their terms. We get to see how they interact with each other. We get to see how they move across the landscape. We get to see how much they care about each other. And then in come the wicked.
Can you give an example of what you mean by how they care for each other? Like I see bears here, and, you know, I almost, in the right time of year, I will daily see mother bears playing with their children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, can you give some examples of the way they care for each other?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times, and this is a sad part, during hazing operations, which tend to take place at the height of calving season, the buffalo are forced to swim across rivers that are full of snow melt and raging, and the little calves can't keep up. They can't do it. They cannot swim those waters, and they try so hard. And the moms or even some of the other family members will go downstream so that they can, their little calves' bodies will rest against the adults, and then they will help shepherd them across the water. There are other situations, and I have a story I could tell you if you want to hear.
Yes,
that.
Please.
there's other situations where, and these have been some of the most profound moments. When the buffalo hunting first started, we didn't know, you know, there's so much we still don't know about buffalo. And the more I learn about them, the more they remind me of elephants and their society and their culture. And we have learned that buffalo, they mourn. They have intense mourning ceremonies. And we didn't really know this. We didn't know this. I'm sure First Nations knew this a long time ago. Until the so-called hunting started. And when, let's say, a bull is shot and he's with a bunch of bachelor bulls, those bulls, they don't run. They go to that fallen comrade and they try. They will paw at him. They'll even stick a horn up his butt and try to get him up. And they keep trying. And it's not until they finally accept that he's not going to get up that they either just stand back a little ways, or sometimes they bed down next to their dead brother. And we've seen situations where there are gut piles all over the place, and a herd of buffalo comes through the area, and they start running around, their tails are up, they're growling. I mean, they roar like lions, like dragons, as you can imagine, a dragon might roar. And it's the most profound thing. I will never forget being on the edge of Yellowstone at Beatty Gulch, which hopefully is going to be closed to hunting here soon. And my patrol partner, Zeth, and I were there, and there were these bulls coming towards a family group that was mourning around all these gut piles, and we knew something intense, really intense, was going to happen. And this massive bull came running in, roaring with, like, just bellowing, and went to every single gut pile, and the bulls started sparring with each other, and they were just spending all their time going around all these different gut piles. And while they were there, the family groups, the mothers led the young ones away, and a funeral procession. It was a very sad exit. They had paid their respects, and they were leaving. And we have also seen buffalo show the same behavior around bones of buffalo that they have come across. We've seen buffalo in a group that aren't being hazed or chased by agents, watching a group of other buffalo that, you know, about a half a mile away, being chased by agents, and they run towards those family members to be with them. There's so many things that buffalo do, and there's so many things that we still don't know about buffalo. But one thing I wanted to tell you, and we can talk about how the rage and anger and sorrow fuels us, but there was a hazing operation in mid-May this year. It was a big one. It was on Horse Butte, which is calving grounds, hundreds of moms and calves, lots of brand new babies, all got chased off of the public lands of Horse Butte. And 2 days later, our patrols in the field discovered an orphaned calf. And so we knew the only way this calf was going to survive was to get into a group of buffalo. Buffalo will adopt. It's a wonderful thing. They have four teats for a reason. They will adopt. And so we knew we had to figure out a way to get this calf with a family group. And as we're trying to, you know, try a few things and figure some stuff out, we look up to the top of Horse Butte, and these two female buffalo are at the top, and they're looking straight at us. And I was like, let's get out of here. They're coming. These girls are coming right now. And so we posted up in a place where we could watch, and by the time we got to our post, those two mamas had already gone into the woods of this peninsula where that calf was last seen, and they were moving. They weren't grazing. They were moving. They had a mission. And so we watched, and we waited, and we saw them, no calf. We saw them a little while later, still no calf. I was starting to lose hope, but then I kept remembering how they were moving, and I knew that it was going to happen. And the next time we saw them, my friend Pat was like, "Looks like they have a baby," and they did. And that little buffalo picked a mom and stuck with that mom, and these girls took the time for this baby to nap, for this baby to drink milk, they grazed, they had come knowing that calf was in there, and they started to get out of our sight, and we wanted to see where they were going. And so we went down and we found them, and both of those females were pregnant. That wasn't even their calf. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever experienced, seeing that happen. And these are the things that we get to experience being with these buffalo, and then these agents come out and they have no clue how the buffalo live. They have no idea what these animals are like. All they know is they want to get them off the landscape, and they do it with brute force. And year after year after year it happens, and year after year we're watching. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been looking through the lens of my camera, and all of us, this happens to all of us in the field, and a buffalo will stop and look at you, and you know they're asking you, why are you just standing there filming this? Why don't you stop and help my people? And that's exactly what you want to do. But we don't do it. It would take us out of the field and for years. And it's just, I feel guilty about that all the time. I feel angry about that all the time. I feel it's very frustrating to, you know, still be doing this. I know we need to be doing this, and I will never stop, but I want to do more. I know we all want to do more, that we all need to do more. But at the same time, it's, you know, I'll talk to my parents, and they're like, God, why? I don't know how you can do it. Why are you still doing this? You're sad or angry all the time. I'm like, how can I not? I can't walk away. I can't walk away from these buffalo. We have to be here. We're all they've got, you know. We have to stand in solidarity with them. And the things that happen to them, it doesn't. I don't want to walk away. I want to do more. I don't want to stop being in the field. I don't want to. It drives me nuts if I'm not out there and something's going on, you know, maybe I'm not on patrol that day. We want to be with these buffalo, and no matter how bad it gets, we're never going to give up on them. They don't give up on us. They don't give up on their instincts. They don't give up on their right to roam, and we're never going to give up on them. It's like that anger drives you to want to do more. I never want to run away from it, you know? I want to be there. I just want to do more, and I don't know what that is. Or I guess I do, but...
Well, it's really clear. It's always been clear to me that, you know, bearing witness is important, but, and I'm not, as you know, I'm not in any way diminishing anything you're doing, because I have such incredible respect for you. And this is true for all of us, that, you know, bearing witness is important, but I think that we need to always remember, too, that it's not enough to bear witness to the end of life on this planet. That's not the point. The point is to stop the destruction.
Yep. What are we going to do?
Well, it's really hard because, like you said, if and we would know, if they were space aliens who were doing this, we would all know exactly what to do. But if we did what was actually required, as you said, you'd be removed from the field. And this is something that we face. It doesn't, you know, once again, this is the same. The sturgeon are floating belly up in the Columbia River right now because of the water's getting too warm. And because of the dams, and you know, the sturgeon have survived. They survived the Missoula flood, and they're not surviving the dams. And you know, this is true. I mean, what have the bison survived over? You know, when did they evolve? 10 million years ago? 5 million? I don't know.
I mean, 800 million years is the beginning from what we know, what we think we know. But I mean, these guys have survived ice ages, you know. They can't survive the government. They can't survive this culture. I mean, they're hanging on, barely.
But they've gone from, how many are there now? Did you say 4,500?
About, approximately.
Yeah, so it's great they've gone from 23 to 4,500, but they've also gone from 60 million to 4,500.
Exactly. And that's a problem.
Yeah, and, you know, another thing I've found, and one of the things I love about you, and is that you, you know, in our communications, you have not shied away from the sorrow and the rage. And, you know, something I used to say in my talk so often is that I would be asked to write an essay about the apocalypse, and then the editor would say, make sure to end on a happy note. And so many people spend so much time and energy, so many environmentalists too, spend so much time and energy trying to avoid feeling that sorrow and rage. And I think sometimes we spend more time trying to avoid feeling that than simply feeling it.
It's. I mean, maybe that's because we're taught that. I don't really know, but it's not reality to do that, and it isn't healthy to do that.
So if you were writing a novel, in which, forget the novel. What do we have? Like 3 minutes left, and I have a couple questions. One question is, what do bison need? You said that they can live on their own. What do they need from us, from you, from me, from people in general?
They need us to stand back and let them walk the earth. Period. It's that simple.
And when there are those who are not letting them walk the earth, what do they need? Well, here's what I think they need. I think what they need is for those who are not allowing them to walk the earth to not be allowed to not let them walk the earth.
Oh, absolutely. It's that simple. It's that simple.
So what do you want specifically from the people who listen to this interview? Well, actually, let's back up. I got two questions now. One of them is, so if they made you the queen of all things bison, and you can't bring down civilization, and you can't stop agriculture, and you can't even destroy the cattle industry. I'm not going to let you do those three things this week. You can do those in 3 years or something, okay? But for right now, you can't do those. Within the current power structure, I mean, what you can do is say, screw you to the cattle people about brucellosis. You can't destroy the cattle industry overnight. Let's pretend this for this little – we're also making you queen of all things bison, so you know you can't complain too much if there's a couple of restrictions. Okay, so what would you do in the current situation for the Yellowstone herd in the short term to help them?
Open up all the surrounding landscape. I mean, just let them use it. It's really that simple.
That's pretty straightforward, pretty easy, frankly. I mean, not politically easy, but that is a straightforward solution that doesn't require bringing down capitalism right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that they need no help from us other than to leave them alone. They need no help. They can walk the earth. There's plenty of land. Just stand back, get out of their way.
So you
enjoy
would
them.
And how much of this land that you would want to open up to them is already public land?
Oh, I mean, tens of millions of acres, and a lot of it contiguous into Idaho and other states.
So even in the short term, a lot could be done, and you and I both recognize that private property is not sacrosanct, so, you know, we're not going there. That's fine. But even in the short term, they could do it without infringing on so-called private property rights.
Absolutely.
Well, that makes the whole thing even stupider, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I feel like I'm living in an X-Files episode all the time. It's ridiculous.
And then, isn't one of the major landowners there a cult?
Oh, the Church Universal and Triumphant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so we'll just leave that as a teaser. So last thing is, what do you want, given the current power structures and given the fact that you are unfortunately not the queen of all things bison, what do you want people who hear this interview to do?
Come to Buffalo Field Campaign. come spend time with the buffalo with us, see what's going on, see for yourself, get to know these buffalo, and the rest will fall into place for you.
And do people, if they were to come there, do they have to be like so fit that they can hike 35 miles in the winter in Yellowstone?
Nope. There's plenty to do depending on, we run lots of field patrols, but no, you don't. We have lots of stuff to do around camp too, lots of office work, in fact, to do, and maintaining the cabin, and there's tons to do for everyone. Anyone is welcome.
So if somebody is not a marathon runner, they don't have an excuse to not actually do this.
That's right. There's no excuse.
Okay.
And we provide room, and we provide board, we provide gear, we provide training. All you have to do is get there.
And is there like a website they can go to find out, or phone number? Do they just, are you easy to find?
BuffaloFieldCampaign.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for everything you've had to say. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Stephanie C. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.